Hey, last week was the New Living Expo here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was on the production team. I was a producing consultant, and I might have mentioned in the past that we had some great people come up from around, actually came out from different parts of the country, but Scott Walter came out and gave an amazing presentation on the Templar Knights' presence in the United States. His presentation was standing room only, probably 400 or 500 people. But some of my favorites were there. Clifford Mahuti, the Zuni elder of the Kachina clan, was there. He came up from Arizona. And Mike Berra talked a little bit. And today's program is going to be is going to capture a couple of presentations, or not actually the full presentation that they gave, but post presentation to kind of touch base with a couple of people that were at that show. I was really impressed both with Mahuti's presentation and Mike Berra, so we're going to be hearing from them in a one-on-one interview shortly. So that's today's program. But if you ever get a chance to hear any of these authors live, you should try to go if they're in your area, simply because when an author writes a book, he's taking just part of his research and compiling it in a paperback book or hardback book, whatever it is. But usually, and I've found this over the years of producing a number of events, they have material that they couldn't put in the book, photographs, graphs, images, but also quite a bit of other material that is provided in a lecture. And it's always good to kind of see what their thought process was behind creating the book, but also it's an opportunity to hear why they decided to write the book, what was compelling, and highlights that you probably didn't get to read because there was too much to put in. So if you can hear an author that you're really enjoying live and in person, try to do it. I've always suggested that to people over the years because a lot of times the material's fantastic. I'll give you an example. When Zachariah Sitchin wrote The 12th Planet, he was actually writing a number of books at the same time. He was writing a trilogy. And when he came out to speak on that book in San Francisco, it was amazing because not only did he talk about the book itself, but he talked about aspects of the book that were providing him content for the next book. And it was just fascinating to hear about the Anunnaki, his belief and theory about it, and then some visual evidence of these giants that apparently walked the earth at one time. So it's an amazing it was fun to listen to that. So anyhow, that's why you need to go hear a lecture. So New Living Expo happens once a year. It was great. It was fun to see. I'm still recovering from it. My girlfriend, Deborah, was there. She went to go see Nassim Harriman, who we're going to have on the show. And he is a brilliant physicist that's talking about consciousness. But he also talks about the mind of the ancients on their ruins. And it was really fun to listen to. He's somebody you have to hear from the beginning to the end because he gets into physics, and if you're not a science person like myself, you really have to pay attention to get the whole breadth of what he's presenting. So, but as my girlfriend said, you have to sit from the beginning to the end and pay attention. Which, if you're the producer of the event, you're in and out of each room, and you're trying to make sure everything's running smoothly. So I wasn't able to pay attention. So when I did sit down for a minute and listen to his presentation, I was going, what? What is this? So anyhow, he will be on the show in June, Nassim Harriman. So stay tuned for that. This week, I want to make sure you have a chance to go to the Facebook page. I posted a number of fascinating galleries having to do with extinct civilizations. And I have one gallery that features a number of skeletal remains that I discovered when I was in Mexico of wide-headed people. We're all familiar with the elongated long heads, cone heads, if you want to call them those, people from Paracas, from Mexico, and from South America. But there's very few galleries on these unusually wide-headed people who it's impossible to have, you know, manipulated their head. These are all naturally occurring growth. People that grew these unusual heads, a different strain of humanoid. These heads are so big that many of them have brain mass that's between 35 and 40% more than what we have. So, you know, double the size, close to double the size of a normal cranial capacity. And we don't know what their role was in the Maya community, where they're sometimes found. I also posted another gallery of elongated heads, fantastically elongated heads. And in a graph that I created in 2013, I actually show this graph. You can see on Facebook. By the way, go to Facebook Earth Ancients and group page. You can see an example of what a typical brain mass would look like. And I had the artist take a illustration of a human brain and distort it in such a way that would fill the cranial capacity of one of these long heads. And it's a side view profile. And you get an idea of just how big the brain of one of these elongated people would look like. And in my research, in my study, these people, at least in Yucatan and in some other areas of Chiapas, when they're profiled, when they're presented in sculptural reliefs, in paintings and figurines, they are what appears to be a priest class. And at that time, the priests were intellectuals and scientists, as far as we know, but they may have also been consultants or whatever. They're portrayed in Ekbalam, which is a city north of Cancun, and north of Chichen Itza, the big main city in Yucatan. They're portrayed in a stucco relief as not a god, but a councilman or perhaps a political figure, and they're, for lack of a better word, ordained to be a person of knowledge. In fact, this one figure that's very well documented, Ekbalam, has wings in the back, and he has a very regal stance. And I've seen many of these in other sculptures, and I've seen them in pottery where the long heads are revered. And we don't know, you know, where they went. Obviously, we don't see people with these elongated heads anymore because they just don't exist. If someone's born with a head like that, it's usually of a birth defect of some kind. But my feeling and a lot of feeling of other researchers are this class of humanoid died out, probably from what you might consider natural selection. And the belief is that the Earth has gone through a number of different periods where various human types were able to exist because either the gravity was less or it was more dense, whatever. We know that Jose Gamarra's father, Alberto Gamarra, believed that there were numerous phases in the Earth's history where it was closer to the sun or pushed further back because of cataclysms, bumping other planets, things like that. We don't know how the Earth was shifted, but it would greatly affect the humanoids on the Earth. And one of the theories is that these longheads or wideheads were developed because of the gravity of the Earth. So could be also just a strain of humanoid that's lost in the evolutionary history. We don't know. It's just weird. But anyhow, check out Earth Ancients. Check out the wideheads, which are very unusual. I think I have about 20 photographs of these dudes. And then check out the cone heads, the long heads. Earth Ancients Facebook group. And they're kind of fun. People have made a lot of comments about them, so check those out. We're going to go ahead and start with this first presentation. This was an interview done with Clifford Mahuti. I was interested in his belief that his ancestors came from Mu, the island of Lemuria in the Pacific Ocean. And in our last talk with him, which was about a year ago, he described this great migration. And so here is a continuation of that and a little discussion about the type of human that was on Earth 25,000 years ago. So here it is.
So I'm here with Clifford Mahuti, and we're at the New Living Expo, and we're actually resting here in the hotel, but I had the pleasure to see Clifford present to a packed room. I think the estimates were standing room only. It's about probably close to 300 people in there, and he had a great slide presentation. And hey, it's great to talk to you again.
Yes, how are you doing?
It's good, great. So one of the things that we talked about when you were on the radio show was this long journey, this trek from Mu, this huge island in the Pacific Ocean that a lot of people consider Lemuria, and this migration, this huge migration, and this is what the elders told you, and these are your ancestors. Is there something unique about those people, about that time period, and the kind of human that was on the Earth?
Well, one of the things they talk about, or at least what identified them as the archaeo Zuni, which were not in a very functional form. When they were supposedly, theoretically, on the island, and one of the things that they had was that they had real odd physiology. They had web feet, they had six toes, six fingers, and a tail, appendage on the bottom. And then I don't know whether it was true or not, but their sexual organs were not in the present stage as the Neo-Zuni, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So when they left the island, when they were going through there, into the ocean, into the new land, they had to have some type of a conversion, so to speak, made when they reached the new land. And this is where the star people or the emissaries of the God's system came down and helped, sort of like evolved the or resurrect the type of human that they're supposed to be, mm-hmm, when they reach the mainland, which is presently what the United States is.
Now, when you say they had webbed feet and six toes and six fingers, was that because they were aquatic also, or was it just a kind of a genetic thing at that point?
I think it was primarily a genetic thing, because when they were on the, on what they call the, where the new beginning was, they, I think that's just the way that they evolved up to that point. And once they got over here to the mainland, where they were given a new route and direction for the new place that they would be, that they had just left, they had to modify their whole physiology. And this is where there's so many background information that has been provided, and this is where they talk about the twin god system. They talk about the ancestors talked about the supernatural beings that were helpful in evolve, or rather adjusting the bodies of the ancient ones, and sort of like in a modification into the Neo-Zuni, because this was a different type of land. This is a different type of requirements for a new land. And so included in that process was also they had to go into the caves. So they were, when they were like that, they had to sort of set themselves backwards as far as their body parts were concerned. And that was another step that they had to do in order for them to become functional. What we call the fourth world. The Hopi, the Zuni, and other Indian tribes call this the fourth world. Because they had left where they were, the land that theoretically was out in the west in the ocean part, they had to come to a brand new type of a land, and they needed that some type of a makeup or the system that they can survive in the new land. So this is where the history and the legends or mythology goes. This is where they had to modify the body part.
Were these humans in possession of great intuition? Were they rudimentary, kind of poorly evolved beings, or did they possess some kind of ability? Because Lemuria, that the Lemuria that I have heard about is Catherwood's description, where these were somewhat enlightened beings, and that they were, in some ways, the term is etheric, which means that they're kind of not really fully embodied or not. But I mean, he got his information from what he believes is decoding some ancient symbology. So it sounds like you have more of a solid handed down verbal interpretation of that period.
Well, one of the things that they talk about is that the first of all, several information received not only from the Indian tribes, that they were sort of like androgynous type people. They were both like a male and a female, but they were also a very spiritual oriented people with what they call compassionate intelligence. And they were very advanced beings. And one of the things that they practiced is that they had peace among themselves. They had a sort of a continuous harmony, not only with the planet, but with also other otherworldly things, especially the etheric beings that they were involved with at that time. Now, we're talking at least 25,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And the Hopis claim that they said, well, according to our calendar, we were around 75,000 years ago. So that because of time is irrelevant, the only way that they can sort of judge it is by the evolution of the species that later on became the...
So if this is 25 years ago, was the migration 25,000 years ago, or did the migration begin after an earth change of some kind?
Well, according to many of the research that I've done, that it actually probably started about 10,000 years ago. And so between 10 and 12,000 years ago is when they had a very cataclysmic event, which was a flooding. The Archaea Zuni was probably at the island. And then about 10,000 years ago was when, according to many, many historians and information that I received from many sources, is that it probably sunk about 10,700 years ago.
Okay.
And so prior to that, they had, because that these were etheric beings that they occupied Lemuria, according to many sources, they started the migrations of a lot of different folks or tribes at that time toward the islands. And this is one thing that's also curious, is that they dispersed to the other islands such as South America. South America and the islands in the Pacific. And there's a lot of ties that went with it, but the mass of the people that migrated to the mainland probably started about that time.
Okay.
And it's in an allegory form, the way that they have explained it about the uplifting of the earth and then the flood, and during the routing, it's saying when one of the places they stopped was in the Grand Canyon, supposedly. And this was where they were, that was the end of the third world. The Hopi, Zuni talk about end of the third world by a flood.
Okay.
So
One of the things I want to get as much clarification as I can from you is, who are these off-world beings, and why would they bother to help these early Lemurians to not only change their physiology to be more successful with the environment? Why? I mean, was there some kind of communication, or did they just have pity on the people, and decided to, you know, show up? Or I mean, what is this, what are the stories? What's the deal on that?
Well, according to the rituals and the system that Zuni, Hopi, and others have, is that they were actually what we call star beings, or what is commonly known as star beings, and they were also the protectors and the creators of the life that had its beginning in what is termed as Lemuria or Mu. But there were other living things all over the planet, other people-type people, living beings, but primarily that group that left Lemuria were guided by these, perhaps the connection of the etheric beings that were occupying the landmass at that time, or Mu, and then they were also supernatural beings, which also what we might consider them today as ancient alien people. There's been a lot of different theories set forth about this type of connection, and they came from different star systems. You take the same parallel with the American Indian, Southwest Indian tribes. They talk about the star people connections from different constellations, different star systems. And so that there was actually a connection with the star beings along with the etheric beings. So perhaps the etheric beings that occupied Lemuria were same stock as the other constellation system living beings. And of course, they were in multidimensional beings.
You know, it's funny you talk about these aliens, or these ancient aliens coming to Lemuria, Mu, and helping them or working to transform them physically. It kind of reminds me of Sitchin's book, where the Anunnaki come down and they kind of genetically re-enhance the humans that are on the earth who are very primitive. This is the Sumerian tale, and make them into their Adam, according to Sitchin, or our Adam, the biblical Adam, and it's much more intelligent, it's much stronger, and it's funny, it's almost like a parallel. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that in this case, that's what the Zuni, they term it in their own language as the creation place that was in the middle of the landmass surrounded by water. And all rituals, prayer system, ceremony, and other spiritually related activities of the Zuni people always start at the west. When we talk about that, our religious order systems, the prayer systems start at the west, and when also throughout the whole life of the Zuni human, after they die, they go back to the west side. Mm-hmm. The Eva, it's sort of like in the Egyptian theory about going back in their boats to wherever they had arrived from. And in this case, with the Zuni, they always go back to the west side, or the westerly direction of where they are at present time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Is there any reverence, prayers said to these star ancestors, these so-called ancient aliens, in today's practice?
Absolutely. They're dependent on the ritual. We talk about, there's even a prayer group that talk about the night priesthood, that and also in this one particular prayer system, it also includes a female portion of it, a male and female portion of it, and also the priesthood of the night sky people. And this is there's always a depending on, again, on the occasion, the ritual or the ceremony. They talk about that, but they always, and everything starts from the west. The moon starts from the west. You see a little phase of the moon, and it completes its life to the east. The sun goes into the west, and they call it the resting place of the sun, or its temple. And a lot of the prayer systems, especially when it comes to the Kachina system, they refer to the west, where they arrive from to go into the villages like at Hopi and Zuni and other pueblos. The other pueblos also have a reference to the west side, and there's many names in that basically means the same thing in all the language groups. It's either called Welima, Wenima, or they even have a term that is used as Hawiku, which is also the name of a place in the Zuni. That's where the Spanish first came and met the Zuni people. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like if you look at the Egyptian names in the Grand Canyon, because it's directly related to the same Egyptian places in Egypt, the same thing that applies in Zuni, that other tribes also refer to, especially our brothers to the south. They always refer to the west, and their names have been transferred to the what they call the new land when they finally arrive there. So it was a very well detailed plan of what they were supposed to do and how they're supposed to get there. So this was so meticulously detailed, and it looks like it was a grand plan that was a master plan.
That's interesting. One last question, and I'm going to let you go. that was a fascinating presentation that you gave today. I missed the last part. Do you? We had a follow-up talk chat about your presentation today. Do you believe that the sightings that you see today are of these overseers, these star people? You said something. You said a percentage were, and then you also said a high percentage were actually U.S. government ships, which I thought was funny. But do you believe any of these connections to the ancient past or some of these beings who might be in these craft?
Yes, I. There's a lot of not only the southwestern Indian tribes, but other indigenous Indian communities throughout the whole, especially the United States. They always talk about the star people. Hmm. We have really actually emphasized this connection within the last 20 years. And this is where a lot of people are not coming out with the information about how their connection with the star people. There's other things that are actually related to it. For example, like UFOs, and they've also have an increase in the amount of activities, especially in these days and ages. And so that is the direct connection of those people that have always been called the caretakers, the keepers of our ways, and the creator is the one that have given these emissaries the duties to look after us. So we have to become humble with them people, the star people, and also to not be egotistical about a lot of these activities that they had given us many, many years ago, thousands of years ago, mm-hmm. and they've always been around.
And do you feel like as a Zuni, as somebody who discusses Zuni prophecy and Zuni functions and lifestyles, that they are an integral part of your life, or is it more like they're the ancestors, they're gone, we honor them, and that's about as far as it goes?
No, it's part of our integral life on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. They're what we call raw people, and these are multi-dimensional beings, and they're also take care of all the other activities related to the planet. For example, the weather control, the weather patterns, the people's ways of what they're doing, and they're trying to control or at least convey to us that we're not supposed to be doing what we're doing, especially in this day and age of how we are affecting what we call Mother Earth and how we're polluting the planet, how we are in negligence in paying homage to the gods that gave us the life, and also allowing a lot of activities that stop the connection or the communications between the god system and the human system that we are in struggles right now. And so this is basically the reason why there's a lot of activity, especially with what people call the UFOs out there, especially on native lands, what's left of the native communities. So this is, I believe that's a direct connection. Hmm.
Okay, hey, listen, thanks for spending a few minutes with me, and it was great to see you here in San Francisco.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. I really find Clifford quite insightful, and it's funny because he's a good friend of David Hatcher Childress, who's a publisher of a number of books, Adventures Unlimited Press, and I've been trying to get him to write a book for as long as I've known him, which has been about a year. And he says he's going to try to write a book because in his presentation at the New Living Expo, he had about 70 or 80 slides of some of the most amazing graphs of different people, of what they call fetishes that are carved. It's just a lot of great material, and I told him he's got to write a book, so hopefully in the next few months he'll get started. He said he was going to get started pretty soon, so anyhow, writing a book is not an easy thing, believe me. I have like 3 or 4 in the works, so that was Clifford Mahody. So next up is Mike Barra, and Mike Barra is the author of Ancient Aliens on the Moon, Ancient Aliens on Mars, Volumes 1 and 2, and also he wrote a number of books with Richard C. Hoagland on NASA, and he is an aerospace engineer with a lot to say about not only NASA, but his knowledge of ruins on Mars and the Moon is first rate. So here is a short interview with Mike Barra. So I have Mike Barra on with me here, and yesterday Mike presented a talk at New Living Expo, and as usual, he drew a crowd. He probably had 150, maybe as close as 200 people in his workshop. And Mike has a lot of really good slides, and I think I was in there for about 10 minutes and I had to jump. But Mike, welcome. Nice to have you on for a few minutes.
Thanks. Well, I mean, do you think it was that many? That's pretty cool. I'll take those numbers, you know.
Yeah, I think it was 125, 150, but it was a good number of people. We were happy, you know. I mean,
good. Well, you know, you try to entertain people, and you obviously want to have folks there speaking that people want to hear. So I'm glad I was able to draw a good crowd. It makes me feel good.
Yeah,
like I earned my money.
Yeah, no, you were good, of course. And then you were on the alien UFO panel on Saturday, mm-hmm. and that was standing room only. In fact,
yeah.
It's funny,
yeah.
you posted, I have to ask you, you have an interesting camera. You took a panoramic shot of that room, which is fantastic, and virtually every single one of those seats was filled.
Yeah, it's true.
For that panel. So that's a help. Is that what is that feature called on your phone when you did that?
Well, it's called Panorama. it's a panoramic feature on your iPhone that you can just, you know, you just hold it down, you click, and you just slowly scan the room, and it can take the entire thing. It's really cool. I can do it because I just like to, and I usually take pictures of the crowd. I mean, I took a picture of the guys at my workshop or lecture, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I like to do that because I like to appreciate, you know, the fact that people come to see me, and it's something that's to be grateful for. So, you know, it's just one of those things, and I get to include them in what I'm doing, and I really appreciate that.
Okay, well, hey, tell me what you felt about that panel discussion. You had a nice little group there. Clifford Mahoti, the Native American Zuni elder,
mm-hmm.
was talking about star people. Sean David Morton, I don't know what he talked about.
Pretty much everything.
Everything in the world, yeah. But what did you
yeah.
feel? How did you feel that was a more cohesive panel discussion?
Well, it was good. It was good. You know, personally for me, I like the panels, but how I feel they should be is really tight time frames on us. I mean, most people know who most of us are, so it's really not, you know,
yeah.
quick introduction. This is who I am. This is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer the panels where the audience asks the questions, not the moderator. And kind of what happened was is that we had a few people, and I'm not going to name any names, Sean, who, you know, went way over their time. You're supposed to speak for 5 minutes. And
mm-hmm.
they, you know, different people have different interpretations of what 5 minutes is, I guess. And there were
yeah.
there were a couple speakers, and basically they ate up, you know, gobs of time. And then we had one question from the moderator, and then it was over. And I felt...
Wow.
I felt bad for the panel folks, the people that came, because what I like to do is get the interactive thing going, is where they start asking
yeah.
us questions. And that's, to me, the most exciting and the most fun. So I think that the panel was either a little too short, or it was just, you know, the moderator's got to control the speakers because speakers don't tend to control themselves.
Well, that's too bad. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I'm sorry I couldn't stick around. You know, you had 90 minutes for that panel, and so you had a couple people burn through 90 minutes. Wow. Okay.
It got eaten up. Got eaten up to the point where there was the opening statements, and, you know, there were seven of us on the panel. There maybe could have been one or two fewer. But, you know, I mean, it's primarily, you know, I think that the panels are good for promoting your own individual lectures and workshops. But it just worked out that the time just got eaten up. So, you know, it was just all of a sudden it was over.
Yeah. Shoot. Okay.
Which was okay with me because it meant I could go back to the bar and drink. So, you know, it was okay.
Okay. Hey, well, let's talk about your workshop a little bit. Like I said, it was well attended. I did notice some slides from your book. Why don't you give us a kind of a general overview about what that topic was, and then I want to jump right into this new book that you're working on, which I guess is going to be out in the fall. But the bottom line and what some of your latest discoveries are out there in space?
Well, the first part of the lecture was about some of the recent stuff that's been, you know, in the news, stuff about the dwarf planet Ceres, where they have this very, very bright glowing spot inside of a crater, which, you know, NASA's trying to tell people is salt. I've never seen glow in the dark salt before. And the truth is that this stuff literally glows in the dark. It is so bright, that it's just way past any possible, it has to be energy. There has to be power coming from it to be as bright as it is. And I showed one slide where, you know, the Ceres was in darkness. And yet this bright, glow just keeps reflecting back at this incredible level, this very, very high albedo. And, you know, that's just not possible for it to be natural and to be reflecting light like that. So I was, you know, talking about that. And then we dug in a little bit into the recent news on Planet 9 or Planet X, which was discovered a sort of a Neptune-sized planet out in the far distant solar system. And what I was reminding people is that, you know, myself and Richard C. Hoagland, and then me again in my book, The Choice, in 2010, you know, predicted that we were going to find at least one and maybe two massive planets out there in the outer solar system. And they would have they would be at a certain distance from the sun, and they would have a certain orbital period. And as it turned out, this Planet 9 pretty much fits those parameters almost perfectly. So, you know, again, this is not Sitchin's Nibiru. This is not the Planet X that that NASA has been searching for 20 years or so. This is Barra and Hoagland's Planet X. I think it's important for people to understand that because once again, you know, the independent researchers, the UFO researchers, guys like you and me and those of us that do this, you know, we're way ahead of NASA. And we appear to be way smarter than them because whenever they do make these discoveries, they're making them along the lines of what we predicted. And then I dug into to the discovery of water on Mars recently that NASA announced.
Okay, before we go to Mars, let me just ask you about Planet 9. Now, is Planet 9 predicted to have an atmosphere that would support life?
Well, no, not at this time. It doesn't seem to be that doesn't seem to be the case, but nobody really knows what it's made up of yet because it hasn't actually been observed. What we've actually seen is its gravitational effects on other small planetary bodies like Sedna and so forth that are out there orbiting around. I hesitate to say the Kuiper Belt because I don't think there's any proof that the so-called Kuiper Belt actually exists yet, but you know, orbiting out there at great distances. So we haven't actually observed it yet. And until we can observe it and do some spectroscopic analysis, we're not going to really know what it is made up of. But it's most likely a gas giant type planet like Saturn or Neptune or Uranus.
And how many light years away is it from us? Guess.
Well, it's not any light years away. It's It's about 50 billion miles away at probably its closest approach, which is exactly where me and the Hoagie said we were going to find another planet. Is 50 billion, not light years, 50 billion miles away.
Okay.
Right where we said it would be. It's in an exact orbit that we said it would be. And, you know, I made very specific predictions in my book, The Choice, and I said, you know, that there's this hyperdimensional physics theory, and if it's correct, then we will find at least one and possibly two more planets about 50 billion miles out with a 13,000-year orbital period. And right now, the closest estimates are it's 50 billion miles out with about a 15,000-year orbital period. So we're dead on right in the ballpark, you know. And that's just, it's really gratifying to be confirmed. So
okay. And so what would be the next bit of analysis? Is there a satellite that's going to swing by someplace, or do we have to depend on the Hubble telescope to tell us?
Well, now we have to use instruments like the WISE instrument that's out there that's looking in the infrared. We have to use telescopic observations. And we, you know, again, it's a space is really big. So we have a very, very wide field that we have to look at, but we have a, we've narrowed it down a little bit, and we have kind of a general area that they're looking, and they're going to basically scan that area first. And fortunately, what we have now is we have the mathematical calculations that give us a really pretty good idea where we're going to find it, like the plane of the orbit and so forth. And I, you know, I'm very optimistic that eventually we're going to find it visually. And then we can say for sure that it's actually a discovery.
Okay, that's interesting. All right, let's talk about your sweet spot, and I call it the sweet spot because you've written two books, Ancient Alien on Mars 1, Volume 1, Volume 2, and so this is your baby. And so you started, before I interrupted you, talking about water, and it's kind of a pain to hear NASA. It's almost like it's so – From an independent investigator's point of view, it's really flat and boring to hear them say, "Oh, we've discovered water." So, what do you want to say about that?
Well, I mean, that was another one of the things that was recently in the news. And again, not to continue to toot my own horn, but when you're right, you're right, you know. And way back in 2001, we published the Mars Tidal Model paper online, where we basically said that these dark slope streaks, these dark streaks that come run down the slopes of craters and mountainsides are liquid water stains that are drying up, evaporating in the Martian atmosphere. And of course, at that time, it was believed that you could not have liquid water on Mars, that it wouldn't last for more than a split second. And we said no. And one of the reasons behind that was that we predicted, based on a whole different number of factors having to do with the fact that Mars was actually the moon of a planet that exploded and not a planet in and of itself, but basically on all these different factors, that it was going to be a very salty, briny kind of water solution. You know, and lo and behold, 15 years later, NASA comes out and says, well, these dark slope streaks that have been photographed and they seem to dry up, we think that they're water, and it's a very heavy, salty, briny kind of water. So essentially, they completely validated the predictions that were made in 2000 and 2001 by myself and my coworker. And, you know, again, there's no acknowledgement of us at all in the literature. NASA says, we've discovered water on Mars. Well, kind of like, no, you didn't. It was actually discovered by us 15 years ago. But given the fact that you know, I'm kind of a rogue Mars researcher who's into the face on Mars and all kinds of other things, there's just no way in a million years they're going to give us credit for anything, because it gives the rest of what we're talking about credibility.
The Pandora's box has opened, and then the whole Cydonia region is exposed, and then the other areas. Now, you talked a little bit yesterday about the pyramids in Cilicium. What's that area?
Elysium.
Elysium. And you were comparing, funny that, because you were comparing the satellite, the pyramids on Cilicium to the ones that are found in China, which I thought was kind of interesting. And when I actually looked at it, they are shaped quite like those pyramids in China. Is there something new there, or is it just more, was that more of a reference point that you were bringing out?
Well, Yeah, Clifford, I mean, they're virtually identical. There's a couple of pyramids in China that have been discovered that have been shown up in Google Earth. And I was just going through one day looking at them, and I was also curious for one of my Mars books to write up a little bit about Carl Sagan's Pyramids of Elysium, which he talked about on the original Cosmos series back in 1980. And they were tetrahedral-shaped pyramids, three-sided, in the Elysium region of Mars. And so I did a search on, you know, pyramid, Elysium, that kind of thing. And I got a link to a Mars Orbiter camera image, which was not a three-sided pyramid, but a four-sided pyramid, partially buried on the Martian surface in isolation, which is another way you can tell something is artificial because, you know, mountains can be pyramidal, but they're only pyramidal if they're part of a mountain chain. They don't form that way in isolation. And, you know, I lined them up and they were an exact match. I mean, the sides of them, the structures were collapsing, the walls were sort of caving in exactly the same fractal degradation pattern, fractal erosion. And so I'm like, okay, if this one we know for a fact is artificial and you overlay it on top of the one on Mars, the odds to my mind go way, way up that the one on Mars is also artificial because there's just no real good natural explanation for it. So to me, that was just a great example of, okay, prove me wrong on this one, guys.
Yeah. You know, you have issue with Dr. John Brandenburg and his nuclear explosion bit, but you kind of do agree upon the fact that there's other man-made structures throughout the surface of Mars. I guess before we leave Mars, what's hot on Mars right now? What is a new focus? Because there's multiple postings every single day on various Facebook pages of images that look like motors and piping and building foundations
and a Glock pistol and a crab. And yeah, I was actually a little bit disappointed because there were images that I wanted to show that didn't come out very clear on the screen. And this is one of the things at conferences that is kind of a pet peeve of mine, which is that you have to create, you know, darkness around the screen, because sometimes you lose resolution, especially when you're looking at detailed stuff on these projector screens. So that was kind of a pet peeve of mine. But there's all kinds of stuff. There's what appear to be fossils. There are things that – one thing that looks like a stormtrooper's helmet that pretty much is some sort of bony structure or helmet or something. I mean, there's water on Mars. There's lakes and so forth. There's all kinds of stuff all over the planet, and it's just a continuous basis. I mean, there's folks that are doing this research, Neville Thompson, various guys that I follow on Facebook, and they're just always coming up with amazing different things on the planet Mars that they're posting. And, you know, my philosophy is if it looks like a piece of machinery, it probably just is a piece of machinery. And the fact that it's on Mars doesn't dissuade me from that. So, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that you could talk about with regards to that.
But, I mean, other than Cydonia, which obviously to me has a lot of elements of surface and underground canals, possibly a city, is there another area of Mars that has elements of Cydonia where it looks like it either took a hit from a bomb or an asteroid hit that evaporated the atmosphere and then just the zero atmosphere destroyed what it was on the surface? I mean, is there any place else like that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole southern hemisphere of the planet has been bombarded by an incredible amount of debris, and I think that that's from the exploded planet that Mars once orbited. Mars was in a tidal lock relationship, just much like the Moon is in a tidal lock relationship with the Earth, meaning it always shows the same side, same face to the planet Earth, and Mars was the same way. And then when this planet exploded, it just completely blasted the planet, ripped away the atmosphere, caused the survivors to live underground, which is why you see these monuments on the surface at Cydonia, and then you see them underneath in the infrared images and stuff. So I think what you've got is a situation where you've got multiple layers of civilization there on the planet Mars. And are there other areas besides Cydonia? Yeah, everywhere. I talked about an area called Parrot City, which is in the Argyre Basin. And it is an entire city complex with streets and roads and houses and factories and you know, it looks like there was a, it looks like Flint, Michigan or something back in the day when they used to produce cars. You know, here's where the cars are. Here's all the split level housing. Here's
the
main factory. Here's the exhaust vents. Here's the loading dock where they would obviously bring the supplies. And so there's stuff like that that I can go into great detail about. So there's stuff like that everywhere on the planet Mars. I mean, literally just all over the place.
I mean, I agree with you on a lot of those points. What's fascinating is, and for those of us, those of you who are listening, Mike's second book, Ancient Aliens on Mars, Volume 2, he actually took photo images from the European Space Agency, who sent up a unique type of satellite that had not only stereophonic visioning, but could take detect, it had night vision capability to detect.
Infrared capability, color imagery also. There was Mars Odyssey, which had infrared on it.
But your work was really brilliant in showing the superstructure, not only of the face, because a lot of the face has been damaged through age, one. And it's been collapsed.
Age erosion.
Was really fantastic. But You also show scans of the surface of Mars where it appears, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is underground activity of some kind, either lights or an engine system that's perpetually in motion that's causing heat to rise to the surface or something. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that explanation, to my mind, it's like NASA probably has equally sophisticated camera work is probably picking that up too. And
I'm sure they have.
They have it from that going back there and going, what the hell's going on under the ground? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, literally, it's right out of the film Forbidden Planet, where nothing survives on the surface to speak of. And really, Forbidden Planet, the film Altair 4 is really Mars. I mean, it really is Mars. even though symbolically it's something else. And they're telling you the story, the real story of what happened to Mars, that there was this incredible war of some kind, and everything above ground is pretty much wiped out or in ruins, but everything below ground is actually still working. The lights are still on. And we found this from Mars Odyssey 2001 infrared images that were released. And you're right, NASA, ASU, Dr. Phil Christensen, they clearly, obviously have much, much better versions of these images that they released, but we can only work with what they released to us. And Keith Laney, very brilliant image analysis guy from North Carolina, did a lot of the work with it. And one of the things we did was at the time is we took visual images that we had from the Odyssey and overlaid them on these infrared images. And that's when all of a sudden this whole cityscape underground at Cydonia, under the ice, just came out. And again, we're talking buildings, roads, bridges, temples, skyscrapers, all of this buried under about 1,400 feet, we think of ice, and showing you this incredible tunnel system and what look like trains and trams that run back and forth to various above ground structures. And it really is quite extraordinary stuff. And that's what gave me the idea for the face on Mars imagery you're talking about, which is that, you know, there's only so many images of the face that are actually directly overhead. NASA has a habit of taking things off to the side. But if you can take all those different visual images and if you start laying them one on top of the other and combining them together, what you see is more and more and more detail. And so what's actually happened with that to my mind is that, you know, the different images we've had of the face, none of them, they're all different cameras, they're all different hardware, they're all different software, they're all different lenses. And really, none of the cameras has really captured what everything that's down there on the face. But when you combine these 5 to 7 different data sets together, wow, then all of a sudden you start to see this extraordinary structure. You see the teeth in the mouth. You see the support structure on the left-hand side of the face, the left cheek or the right-hand side from our perspective. You see the nostrils and the nose. You see the eye socket. You see the pupil. You see the tear duct. You see the eyebrow. You see this beveled platform, which is completely symmetrical. that it it stands on. And there's no such thing as a mountain anywhere in the solar system that is symmetrical, that is not artificially constructed, you know? So it's just really, truly amazing stuff. And there's even more work that should be done on that than I even have time to do.
I'm going to ask you, I think I asked you this before when I had you on the show. You know, the European Space Agency's satellite was positioned in such a way that the face was all the details, as many details as we could find or get, were shown in those images. And then here's the Malin camera from NASA or Jet Propulsion Laboratory taking what they call their best reference of the face, and it looks really crappy.
Yeah,
it's really crappy. Now, doesn't that show them up and embarrass them?
It doesn't embarrass them if nobody challenges them on it in the scientific community, and nobody ever does. And Malin and his cohorts did, and what they've kind of done with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is they like to shoot the face at oblique angles and then stretch it and distort it and say, oh, well, we're auto correcting it. You know, we're orthographically correcting it so that we can get a more direct view overhead. And that ends up looking completely different than, for instance, the European Space Agency images, which were taken directly overhead with the face basically at 90 degrees to the lens of the camera. So those are the best pictures. They'll show you what you're really getting. There's only about 4 or 5 sets of data that were directly overhead where you don't have to do a lot of stretching, pushing, and pulling. And so, you know, of course, the ones that the news media and NASA always promotes are the ones that are the most distorted. So it's a trick, it's a game, and you have to be really smart to kind of catch them at it. And it also makes it difficult to talk to an audience about, because it's a very technical argument, that aspect of it. So I've reached the point where I just take the good pictures, combine them together, and show people this is what it actually looks like. And it's really, I think, some extraordinary stuff. So,
do you think the Chinese who have their satellites out there, and I don't know if it's the Italians or somebody else, do you think if they were to take, because they took some very interesting photographs of the moon a few months ago that I thought were very unusual because the coloring was unique, and they said there was no retouching. Do you think that the Chinese took some photographs of the surface and they revealed something that the United States would kind of fess up to, anything, or would it still be the same?
No, I don't think the U.S. will fess up to it. I think even if they were to take pictures that showed the face on Mars in all of its true glory with all the support girders and structures and everything everywhere, NASA would just ignore it, not comment on it, and pretend like it didn't exist. That's what I think. Or say, well, obviously that's not what you think it is. And I'm like, really? It sure looks like what I think it is.
No, I mean, like I was just saying, you showed those infrareds of heat, the sun reflecting or heat reflecting off the girders of the face, deep infrastructure. The thing's a monster. It's a mile and a half long by a half a mile wide or whatever. It's a monster.
And a mile and a half by a mile,
Yeah, the superstructure to create that thing must be monstrous. So for them to show that with great clarity would be just like, here it is, you know. Well, what can you say?
It would be the smoking gun. Yeah, it would be the smoking gun. So
I mean, people would go, we got to get our ass over there now with man. You know, we got to have a manned flight to Mars, right?
Yep.
Anyhow, okay. Well, look, let's talk about your new book. You hinted on it. It's not going to be out till the fall.
Right.
What
haven't started yet.
What can we? No. You're supposed to be saying I have tremendous notes and I have a tremendous.
Well, I'm doing research. I am researching it. I will say that.
So
well,
what's
the
it about?
Book title will pretty. It'll tell you pretty much everything. It's called Hidden Agenda, NASA and the Secret Space Program. So it's looking at, you know, there's all kinds of people talking about the quote secret space program who really I don't think are giving information that's really very reliable. It's kind of, I don't know, a lot of just you know, noise, and there's not much really substance behind it. So what I thought about is, you know, this is unfortunately my curse in life, is I can't just kind of make stuff up and tell good stories. I have to actually go through and research stuff and try to support my argument. And so I decided that it might be worthwhile to go through and look at NASA's involvement with various different types of unusual technologies, anti-gravity technologies, and so forth, and see if there really was some evidence that there is a secret space program of some kind. And, you know, it turns out there's an awful lot of information that indicates that there is. It indicates that NASA was deeply involved in some of this stuff, along with many, many major aerospace companies. The technology appears to have come from either Nazi Germany and the Nazi Bell and various experiments that were done there, or some of the technology appears to have come from actual alien crashes, you know, crashes of flying saucers. That is a distinct possibility. And so as I dug into this, I really got more and more fascinated by the depth of the information, and I decided there's a book here. So now what I'm doing is focusing on that book and trying to get this all together in time for the fall, when people can hopefully enjoy it and you know, follow the pattern. I'm going to do it chronologically. I'm going to do it from way back into the 1800s, when the search for anti-gravity really began, and follow it all the way through to today. What are we seeing actually today in modern times?
Okay. Well, that's my next question for you. I have spent some time with Clifford Mahoti and some other people that see a lot of these night sky lights and craft flying around out in the desert, out in the reservation. He had somebody tell him, and he won't say who it was. He says ex-military. He believes 80% of the craft that we see now considered UFOs is Earth-based, with a percentage of 20% being off Earth. What do you say about that?
I don't think that's unreasonable. I mean, it looks to me as though we probably made a breakthrough in anti-gravity technology probably in the late 1950s. We probably were able to practically operate the craft in the 1960s. And I think the vast majority of what we've seen in the skies probably is of our own construction. I like to tell people that if it's a disc-shaped object, it's probably one of theirs. If it looks like a Dorito, it's probably one of ours. that's my philosophy.
That's funny.
Yeah, you know, there is something about the disc shape, though, that seemed to make these various anti-gravity effects more capable, more prominent. And, you know, I'm just, again, this is one of the parts of this story that I'm going to be digging into as I develop this story, this book, this story that I have to tell. So.
Okay. Well, that'll be fascinating, because there's so much peculiar material on that area. I mean, there's these ships that we don't know about. There's Mars. There's the moon. There's just so much strangeness that isn't explained to us by the government that we pay taxes to give us an understanding, to go out and do the research. So.
Well, just because we pay them taxes doesn't mean they feel obligated to tell us the truth. Let me just clarify that right away. So just one of those. It's not like it's not like that makes them indebted to us. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so here's another one, real quickly, and then we'll end it. So, who, if Trump were to become president, what do you think he would do in terms of this whole question of UFO alien interaction with the military and the government?
Well, I think it's completely unpredictable. And I think that is what is so deeply frightening about Donald Trump to many people, is nobody knows what he's going to do. Nobody knows what he's going to reveal. You know, he's very direct. He doesn't beat around the bush. And, you know, one of the things, there's been rumors for quite some time that Hillary Clinton is rather seriously ill, like she may be actually fighting cancer. And if you listen to the things that Trump says, what Trump is consistently saying is things along the lines of, you know, one of the reasons why I'm going to be a better president than Hillary Clinton is because, you know, I've got the stamina. She doesn't have any stamina. I've got the stamina to carry through with these, you know, this, the responsibilities of being president, and yada, yada, yada. So he's always bringing this up. And I mean, he's very clearly taking a shot across her bow saying, I know that you're sick and I'm going to expose that you are sick. And I think he's been doing this constantly. If you listen to his statements and his conversation, so I think really, really, you're going to be quite surprised by that. And I, you know, the truth is, I don't know. I don't know if he's going to go into the UFO thing or not. I just think that his appeal is that he is not really owned at this point by anybody. And I think that's a real that's something that he, you know, is going to be a big advantage for him.
Because he's not he doesn't need the big business to fund him. He's funding a lot of his own stuff. Is that what you mean?
He's funding it himself, so he doesn't have to take any money from anybody, and that gives him a certain degree of independence that nobody else can really has ever had. So it's going to be quite unique, quite shocking, I think.
Okay. All right.
I mean, I think Trump's going to win, and I think it's going to be a lot of mind blowing stuff.
Don't say that, because that's scary.
Oh, it'll be a good. It's not nearly as scary as the last 8 years. Come on, it'll be fine.
The guy has insulted all of our allies,
Obama's the one who's been insulting all of our allies. He hasn't insulted our allies. He's insulted our enemies, which is a whole different thing. So, you know, I don't know. Just come on, relax, breathe. Let's see what happens.
we don't want to get political on the show here.
No. I mean, it's really – I really don't. I mean, politics does matter. I think that they – you know, the powers that be don't necessarily dictate who wins, except maybe the last election. I think there was definitely some interference. But it is said that they dictate our choices, you know, like which choice do we have? Do we really have that many, you know, different options? And, and in reality, I think I think this is one that they didn't plan on. And I think they're very shocked that this is happening, but I hate to say this, I predicted exactly this type of political and financial upheaval in my 2010 book, The Choice. So if you really want to know what's going to happen and what's been happening and why it's happening, go pick up The Choice.
Okay. Hey, Mike, thanks for spending some time with us. We'll check back with you probably in the fall. Is this going to be David Hatcher Childress published this book coming up?
It is indeed. It is going to be Adventures Unlimited Press. So, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Fantastic.
I'm glad
to hear it. All right, Mike, thanks again. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, we'll talk then. Thanks, Cliff.
It was Mike Barra. Always great to have him on the program. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Again, if you get a chance to go and hear any of these people in person, you should do it. And I invite you to come out next April here in the San Francisco Bay Area. If you are in the area, come out to the New Living Expo. I try to work with the producer, Ken Kaufman, to bring some of the best people around the country, if not the world. Sometimes we bring people from different parts of the world to come out and speak, to speak about not only their books, but their points of view. And it's always fascinating. It's always fascinating to hear. So New Living Expo, come out next year. By the way, you can go to newlivingexpo.com, and there are different types of presentations you can download for a fee. And if you want more information on that, send me an email at cliff@earthancients.com, and I will send you some information on New Living Expo. So look forward to it next year in April. So, all right. Well, that's it for today's program. I want to remind you, our guest next week is John Major Jenkins. For those of you who don't know who he is, he wrote the book 2012. And is a expert on Mayan calendars. I've never had John on the program. I've been a real big fan of his. He has is one of the academics that has crossed over and doesn't follow the path of the academic profiling of the Maya. He's more on my has more of my kind of focus, which is that they were multicultural, inherited much of their knowledge from a previous civilization. But what brings what's interesting about John is that he has interpreted these calendars in such a way that we really get a good insight as to what the thought process was behind a lot of their Maya thinking. And the book 2012 was huge. And we're going to hear about what has happened since 2012, the new the things that have come true, and some of the things that are up and coming. So stay tuned for that. That's next week, Saturday the 14th. I hope you have a great day. Bye-bye.